It's Friday, and welcome to another edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. This is where I, John Zogby, join with my son, Jeremy, and business partner to discuss the important week in the news. And there is one issue, of course, that dominates our lives this week. And I must say that, Jeremy, you were in the forefront of this whole thing. This is our 11th edition. And if we go back to listen to our very first, you were talking about the coronavirus and its potential even back that far. So aside from the news that's dominating our lives, how are you doing today?
You know, hanging in there. Our listeners from last week will recall that not only do I have a toddler, but I've got a baby due any day now. And my wife is mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually prepared for that. And so am I. And we're just awaiting Isabella's welcoming into this world. I'll just kick off a brief intro and then let you get into it, Dad. First off, I want to say this is going to be one of those podcasts where we merge history, historical data with present data. We have a new poll out hot off the press. Of course, our monthly poll with Forbes, but I just want to step back and say a couple weeks ago on our ninth podcast, the theme was America and the world at the crossroads. Following the next week, the episode 10, the theme was a medical 9/11. And so here we are in the 11th podcast, and looking back on those two themes, here we are, and wow, we're here. And I can't help but think of a historical analogy such as crossing the Rubicon. I said, week nine, we were at the crossroads. I didn't imagine that the crossroads was the site of the Rubicon River, metaphorically, figuratively speaking. And what I mean by that is, of course, those who have read about Roman history know that 49 years before Christ, Caesar crossed the Rubicon and the Roman Republic was no more. It turned into the Roman Empire. Life, culture, everything changed from the top down. And here we are, and the whole world is at the Rubicon River. Life will not be the same. I'm very confident in saying that. We discussed it a little bit last week about the medical 9/11 and the rollout of new measures. Once those measures go full in effect and they're rolled out, they don't disappear. So that's the backdrop to all of this, weaving in the poll, because our poll is not only about the election, but it's also about how our life has changed according to the view of 18 to 29 year old likely voters nationwide. So, Dad, why don't you kick off some of the highlights from this new poll, fresh off the press? What stood out, and what are you paying attention to?
Yeah, this is a fascinating poll because and very timely, not simply because of the virus, but because, you know, there's been so much news this week about millennials and how they are not responding well as good people or good citizens to the onset of this virus. You know, the pictures of the crowded beaches in Florida and the selfies being taken in crowded bars in defiance of what are in some states mandates and in other states, you know, powerful suggestions that we need to stay home. So we wondered how millennials are responding. And here's some of the things that we found: that a plurality of these 18 to 29 year olds, and I should say they include Gen X and younger millennials, 46% view the notion that the U.S. will experience a full-blown crisis like they've seen in China or Italy, versus 36% who view this as an overhyped temporary condition. And the rest are not sure. But at least we know that a plurality of young voters feel that way. So we also want to know, have you changed your lives? We found that two out of three, 66%, say they're washing their hands multiple times a day more than before. 46% say that they're working less than before. 59%, three out of five, say that they're joining friends socially less than before. 43% say that they're dating less than before. And 61% are going out to dinner less than before, as are 56% who say that they're going to the gym less. Not a perfect reaction. In some ways, you might even argue a troubling reaction. Those are majorities and pluralities, but the flip side of that is that there are still a substantial number who are just staying the same the way they are, or you know, a relatively small amount who are saying that they're doing those things even more. What do you think about that?
Well, I was going to ask you the same, because, you know, being in the world of media is a little bit new to me. I'll have some thoughts, of course, but, you know, I mean, you've seen the changes in media over the course of actually over more than four decades. So what I wanted to follow up with before I give any reactions to that is, so we see substantial numbers who are playing it safe, but yet the headlines are telling us that they're irresponsible. If you were the executive of a newspaper or a network news agency, how would you grapple with, we could say almost divided or something almost split? How do you accurately represent this age cohort when maybe the pictures in the news and the data doesn't necessarily add up?
All right. You know, very good question. So as an executive of the news, I have two responsibilities. One is to try to tell the truth, and the other is to either get clicks or keep my ratings or raise my ratings. Well, obviously, young people at the beach, some young man from Ohio being quoted as saying, "Corona, no corona, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to party. Nothing's going to stop me being going to a party." That is sensational. That generates clicks. That's the sort of thing that a media executive says, "Wow, what a great story!" And it is. And then in turn, that goes viral, and that young man is, at least his face and his words are famous. Flip side is that I want to tell the truth. And the truth is, it's much more nuanced than that. That, sure, young people aren't watching television, you know, or listening to traditional media. But insofar as they're listening to themselves, they're seeing what may appear to be an overblown sense of those who are on the beaches and those who are partying, when the reality is that there are many, many more who are being responsible. By the same token, it's time for commentators to, instead of expressing outrage, recognize, I think, those who are playing by the rules, those who get it, and to encourage more to get it. And that may involve then the commentators bringing on the 18 to 29 year olds who are abiding by the rules and explaining them why they understand the need to do that. One of the, and this is not new to millennials or to Gen Z. You've heard me say many times, there's a difference between an age group, which is where you are in the life cycle, and an age cohort, which is where you stand as a young person or a middle-aged person in history. The age group of 20-year-olds tend to focus on themselves and their own immediate needs, and at the same time, they also have a sense that they're invulnerable. Well, light up a cigarette? Well, I may get cancer 50 years from now. I'll deal with that. Go out, go and party, as this kid said. I may get corona, but that'll be years from now. For now, I'm going to have fun. That is the sense that needs to be combated. It's more than treating these young people as millennials or Gen Z. Needs to attack young people where young people are at their lives, in the life cycle.
Yeah. I would say that the coverage of this aspect of the story is very irresponsible. First of all, and I can't say the news in general, because it's not every media outlet, but it's a significant amount of the media that are portraying this. But the first mistake is they're conflating millennials with Gen Z. And Gen Z, of course, we can only poll because we only poll adults. Gen Z in a poll is only going to be 18 to 24. So right there, who is more likely, or who are the only age group that are going to go on a spring break, are college students. That's Gen Z. That's not millennials. It's not people who are 27, 28, 29. I mean, maybe a few here and there, and probably most certainly not people in their 30s like myself are going on, you know, going to Cancun or, you know, going to Myrtle or Daytona Beach to live it up and party it out. So it's conflating the two generations and saying young people are millennials and all young people are irresponsible. And the other aspect is, well, you know, there is a difference between those who are in college and those who are, say, working, are working class, maybe live in West Virginia or live in rural New Mexico, rural Texas, rural New York State, for that matter. Are they going to go to Daytona Beach? Are they going to go to Cancun? Probably not. And I would say it's very misrepresentative. And you alluded to the fact that a lot of it is clickbait. And the flip side to this is, look, this isn't, it's not just the young who are being risky, right? Because let's not forget that boomers were the first real teenagers, right? I mean, they were the ones with the cool haircuts, wearing the leather jackets and smoking and dancing to rock and roll, and then became the beatniks, and then became the Woodstockers, and then became the yuppies in the 80s. And there's a certain portion of them who now in their 60s and 70s still want to party it up. And I've been reading stories that, you know, there were Gen Z and millennials who were pleading with their parents, don't go on that cruise. I think Business Insider did a story on that. And, you know, you saw this dynamic between the young and the old, the young scared to death and the old saying, look, I've got only a little bit more time to live on this earth, and I'm going to go to the casino. I'm going to go on that cruise. I'm going to go on that trip to southern Spain. And so I think, like you said, it's the clickbait. And one of the things that I hope comes out of this, a big change in our culture, is that the whole clickbaitiness of news, of just getting you to zero in on that headline and then having a wild expectation for what the story is, and then come to find out it's overblown, it's overgeneralized. I hope all of that just comes to a complete collapse.
Well, we're going to experience enormous changes. We already are. Most of us are home. Most of us have to be home. You know, the bad news is that so many people, we're just dealing here in this country, and especially young people who have just gone back to work in many instances, or gone to work for the first time in a good job, are being severely hurt by this economy. But by the same token, you know that I walk every day for about an hour or so. And as I was walking through the neighborhood and sensing just the quietude of walking in the neighborhood and frankly, very few cars on the road, I began to wonder if, number one, there may be a more lasting change when it comes to less of the hyperbolic rhetoric that we've been hearing over the last two decades. And, you know, just much more of a sense that perhaps we're all together on this and on the experiencing this virus. And that secondly, that there's plenty of time now to maybe slow down and become a bit more introspective and ask, what is it that I really want out of life? You know, a real change is the nature of our relationships as well, as we do see folks less. Here are young people, substantial numbers saying that they're dating less, that they're going out to dinner less, socializing less. Here's the question. We've been here to some degree before. There was World War II. You know, that was massive. The entire economy didn't suffer, but it had to be geared toward war. People were denied consumer products. People lent money to the government in the form of bonds. There were sacrifices to be made. But after the war, there was a binge, the post-war boom, and then the baby boom. And then I do recall that in the 1970s, two presidents, Nixon and Carter, during energy crises, called upon Americans to sacrifice. You know, turn down your thermostat, put on sweaters, drive less. And the issue was, you know, are Americans going to abide by that? And their resounding answer was yes. And then when the price of oil went back down again, you know, the big cars came out, the thermostats went up. And so I think we have to ask ourselves a question. Is this virus a real game changer? Will we never be the same or act the same way again? I'm going to argue that, yes, it is a game changer. We will never be the same again. We will rely more on technology to promote our business, to deal with interactively with business, to socialize. There will be fewer public gatherings. The end of the town square that we once experienced will now be the end of the large social gatherings. I believe that that will happen. What do you think?
Well, I want to go to your analogy of the Great Depression, and the way that you summed it up was that there was the wartime economy that the Americans sacrificed. Of course, during the 30s, prior to that, the New Deal, Americans got relief from the government. But once World War II came into effect, the government had to raise taxes. Americans had to sacrifice for the war effort. And so we come to 2020, and yeah, I mean, let's be honest. Are we on the verge of a recession? I don't think so. Are we on the verge of a depression? Probably so. Why do I say that? Because Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, has announced that by April 6th, and maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but the way I've read it and understood it, is that every American, and maybe that's adult or household head, I don't know, but let's just roll with every American will receive two checks for $1,000. That is unprecedented. So comparing with the Great Depression, I'm sorry, not the Great Depression, the World War II, where Americans were asked to sacrifice for the government, now the situation has been reversed, in which the government is creating all of this money. And I'm not saying, you know, that's right or it's wrong. I'm not getting into that. I'm just looking at the fact that we've never seen anything like that before. So it's pretty interesting that you know, Mnuchin is, and he was smart to do this because he probably would have sparked a lot of anger and rage if he only signaled to the public, hey, we're here for Wall Street, like pretty much was the case back in 2008 for George W. Bush and Barack Obama, that we're here for Wall Street, but what about the common guy? So Mnuchin has been at least smart enough to realize that he could create a boil over effect if he didn't include Main Street in the stimulus package. I have some data, and all of that that I just said is the backdrop to what could be interpreted as a shocking number. When we asked the 18 to 29-year-old likely voters how they rated the job of Trump handling the economy, a slight majority, 51%, approve. When has that ever been the case for mm-hmm. Trump to get a slight majority, especially from a group of young people? I can't help but think the reason for that is because of the Secretary of Treasury's measures. How do you react to that? What do you think that I...
Well, I think we should note that this poll was taken Wednesday night. And so that so it was taken after Mnuchin's announcement. It was taken certainly at as the trajectory of the growth of this virus was turning almost to 90 degrees, a right angle, you know, doubling of previous virus figures. And so what I make of it is, you know, last week I wrote in my weekly report card for the Examiner, I gave the president an F for not responding to the virus in a timely or serious way. And I used the phrase that he was channeling his inner James Buchanan. And James Buchanan was the president before Lincoln, widely regarded as the worst president in American history because he watched everything unfold between North and South and did nothing, just chose to run the time clock out. But now this week, as I rewrite my report card tonight, this is Friday night, he's evolved from James Buchanan to Franklin Roosevelt and Andrew Yang combined. How a president responds to a crisis, it can be very, very unique. And in this sense, there's been almost a 180-degree turn. The president is serious. He's appearing before the public every day. There are no limits, it appears, to federal largesse. We're talking about trillions the way we used to talk about Benjamins. Democrats calling for $750 billion, the president and his party calling for $1 trillion, and a substantial amount of that is going to the bottom. It's going to small businesses and to individuals earning under $200,000, $198,000. A year. That's for couples, I should say. So, yeah, things have changed. And I think maybe what's happening here is that 18 to 29-year-olds, like everybody else, give higher marks to this president for the economy. Remember, they witnessed under him a boomlet that allowed them to be doing better financially than they have been under previous presidents.
So when we pivot to the question, so we were talking about the approval, and here's an interesting mm-hmm. nuance. And on the surface, somebody would say it's a contradiction, but it's not. When we pivot to the word of rating the trustworthiness, specifically mm-hmm. of Trump's dealing with a situation of this magnitude, only 37% of the 18 to 29-year-old likely voters said that they have trustworthiness in the president. So I'm going to get your take on that. From 51 of approval on the economy, a 44% overall approval of his job rating to a 37% trustworthiness, level of trustworthiness in the president's dealing with the situation of this magnitude. How do you reconcile the data?
Well, first of all, in context, Donald Trump was elected in 2016. With numbers all year that never moved from that 37% who said that they trust him to tell the truth. He happened to run against someone who never moved from the 36%, Hillary Clinton, who said that they trust her to tell the truth. So a majority of voters do not trust, do not consider Donald Trump to be trustworthy. I think in many instances, it's an image that he has cultivated. He likes to be seen as the deal maker, the guy who comes in with the stacked deck, the loaded deck. And hey, if that stacked deck works for me and in some way works for you, that's a good thing. And I guess that, you know, to the degree that the economy has been doing well, or that this week a sense that now that we are very well headed towards some kind of economic calamity, hey, it was a sucker punch, just like 9/11 was a sucker punch, and Bush's numbers went up. But I don't think the American people, and I don't think young people, are ever going to trust Donald Trump. But I do believe that they may give him good marks for responding to a crisis that he has to respond to. What do you think?
Well, in other words, I can approve of the job of somebody that I don't like. I can say I don't like the person, but I'm looking at their job and I can approve of it. However, when you ask me if I trust the person, we're not comparing apples to apples, right? And so here's an interesting example that I think holds this up. When we asked the 18 to 29-year-olds about rating the CDC, I believe it was 70%.
70%.
They have trustworthiness, a level of trustworthiness in the CDC that's the institution's ability to handle a crisis of this magnitude. But when you zero in on Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has become the face of the CDC, he's not from the CDC. He's from the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, but he's the point person for the CDC, I guess you could say the guy giving the fireside chats, right? His level of trustworthiness is at 38%. Why is that? Because he's a part of Trump's team. He's standing next to Trump. That's how I interpret.
So you and I are gonna see this one differently, and that's why we do this podcast. I think in Fauci's case, it's more an instance where he has become a figure of television, and while he's standing next to the president, I think he's cultivated his own image very well over the years, and I don't think that 18 to 29 year olds know who he is. So his 38%. Approval rating on handling the virus has a whole lot more to do with the fact that there are substantially more who are just not sure and not familiar enough. His ratio of approval and disapproval, however, is a very high ratio. There aren't many who disapprove of him. So, I mean, that's my take on it.
I mean, I don't have the percentage of those not sure. That would be very revealing in the notion that they don't know who he is. I can remember for sure it was under 10%. I want to say it was 7 or 9. That would clue me in that there is a level of awareness. I mean, I would say that, you know, the man who came out and said this disease is 10 times more lethal than the flu, that headline caught the attention of the country for days, certainly caught my attention. But you know, let's move on. So we've covered a lot. We've covered this fascinating poll. We're trying to figure out where do we go from here. And you've lived through far more crises than anybody who's 30, 35, 40 years old, you witnessed firsthand the assassination of a president. It was caught on film. You saw it as a kid. And then there was his brother. And then there was MLK, Malcolm X. You talked about when the United States went off the, ended the Bretton Woods Agreement, the panic that ensued and stagflation, energy costs went through the roof, everything. The cost of everything went through the roof. You witnessed the fall, the collapse of the Soviet Union, 9/11. What's your advice to our young listeners on this podcast, how do you bring a perspective with all of that in under your belt and behind you? What do you tell them?
One of the things that has always impressed me about millennials and what I'm seeing as well coming up with Gen Z has been their community orientation, their sense that they want to do something to make their world and their community a better place. And my advice would be, don't focus on yourself as being someone in your 20s who's going to light your personal fire and do whatever it is you can to have fun. Remember, it's not only that your responsibility is to stay healthy for yourself. Your responsibility is to stay healthy for those whom you love and those who you don't even know, but have made or will make some contact with. You have a responsibility to listen to leadership, even if you don't trust them. You have a responsibility to trust science and trust the fact that science and our leadership are saying social distancing, put your life on hold for a while, stay out of crowds, and be careful about the direct contact with people, notably older people who you still need, as well as older people still need you. Don't party on the beach.
Yeah. I guess I would conclude on my part by saying that, we shouldn't lose hope. Most of us in this nation right now are under quarantine. We're indoors. That's very tough. Let's make the best of it. Let's use this time to reconnect with our loved ones and our close ones. Of course, we can still stay in touch with family in other parts of the country. Do as much of that as you can. I would also say, let's not lose the sight of the fact that the previous outbreaks that we've seen over the last 15 years, whether it was H1N1, the swine flu, the bird flu, SARS, MERS, a whole host of them, tended to end. And believe, I'm not getting this, by the way, I'm not getting this information from the president. The fact is there that it tended to end when the earth started to tilt towards the sun and the warm weather came out, and that meant more sunshine, vitamin D, which is one of nature's most powerful antidotes to viruses. That's the case with the flu. The flu goes away once May hits. We should hope, that's going to be the case. We'll be a lot healthier as we get to go outside when it's warmer. Let's hope all of this passes. Let's just get ready for what the new world is, and that it should be up to us what the new world will be. And so we will continue to track the situation as always, and we will be with you next week, same time, same place. And I'm going to say that's a wrap for me on the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. Dad?
I just reached out to a little while ago to a mutual friend, Seth, down in Miami, and just wondering how's he doing? How's the isolation affecting him? And he just wrote this. It just came in. He said, "I'm muddling through. I love Stephen King's novels. Never thought I'd be a character in one, however." That's my parting shot for this podcast. Thanks, everybody, and we'll be talking next week. Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone. Take care, Dad.
Take care.